Chapter 5 is about minimization methods. I will discuss those methods in quite a detail because it turns out that many physical problems actually can be formulated as a minimization problem. So let's start with something very simple, namely how to minimize a one-dimensional function. And I will assume in all those discussions now that we have a smooth function where at least the first derivative exists, and actually later on we will still also use a second derivative because that can make it still much more efficient to find the minimum. So if the first derivative exists, right, it tells us whether the function is increasing or decreasing. And then we can write down this so-called steepest descent iteration, that's equation 22, which says that if we have an initial approximate solution xl, then in the next iteration step, the solution that's kind of better, that should be closer to the minimum, that's this xl plus 1, that's given by the xl minus a so-called step size alpha times the first derivative of this function. So below there's a brief sketch. You see two cases. In the left panel, we start at a certain point xl, where the second derivative is negative. So that means we have to move along the positive direction, along the x-axis, we have to increase x. And of course, there indeed we see the value xl plus 1 is lower than fx of l. And so if you repeat this procedure a few times, then you will converge exactly to the local minimum. On the right-hand side, you just see the opposite case, where now the derivative initially at this point xl is larger than 1, right? So that means I have to go backward, kind of I have to decrease xl. And in this case, yes, you see xl plus 1 is on the left-hand side of xl. And of course, the value there of the function is lower. And so also, if you repeat this iteration a few times, you will arrive at the minimum. It's also obvious that, if the step size alpha is very large, then kind of you could overshoot everything. You could kind of jump on the other side of the minimum. And then if you jump there very far away, then actually I think it's also obvious that the iteration will diverge. So let's now discuss the case where the second derivative exists as well. If that is the case, actually we can speed up finding the minimum significantly. And what we do is now we just do a Taylor expansion of our function around an arbitrary point that I call now x tilde. So that's this equation 23. And now if we have an quadratic function, of course, we can find the minimum exactly with an analytical formula. So what we request now is that the derivative at the point x, so f of prime of x, be 0. And then if we solve equation 24 for x, then we get this equation 25, where I call now x xm, because that should be the value of x where the function takes on its minimum. And it's given by this x tilde, so the initial point, minus the derivative, the first derivative, divided by the second derivative. So, in this case, actually, that iteration could converge to any stationary point. So we'll assume the second derivative is positive, which means that it's a minimum. Yeah, so now, of course, this Newton iteration, as it's called, so this equation 26, is typically not used for quadratic functions. It could be used, but in general, the functions we encounter are more complex. They are not just simple quadratic functions. And then in this case, you need just more than one step, right? If the function is quadratic, then equation 26 will give you in a single step the exact minimum. Whereas if it's not quadratic, you have to make an iteration out of it. But this iteration, the so-called Newton iteration, will then converge to the minimum. So we see actually also that this Newton iteration actually is identical to the steepest descent iteration, that was equation 22, if you put the step size alpha equal to 1 over the second derivative. And we will see actually that's a very important rule in all those minimization methods. We need a step size which is of the order of 1 over the second derivative. Let's now go to the more interesting case where we have a function that depends on several variables, so a high-dimensional function. We can actually again take over the basic concept to derive the steepest descent iteration now for that case. So what we have to do is we have just to replace the first derivative by the gradient, which by definition points in the direction of strongest increase of the function. So hence the minus the gradient points in the direction of the strongest decrease of the function, right? And we want to minimize the function, so we have to move in the direction of minus the gradient. And so we arrive at the steepest descent equation 27. So this step size alpha then of course has to be a positive number, and like we have seen before, it shouldn't be too large to ensure convergence. On the other hand, of course, we can already expect that if this value alpha is kind of too small, then of course you move only by a small amount and you will need many of course iterations to converge. We will discuss in a moment in much more detail how to choose optimal step sizes alpha. Yeah, we can now also again do more or less the same thing we did in the one-dimensional case, namely if now the second derivative exists, that means actually if the Hessian matrix exists, right, which is given by equation 30, which is kind of the generalization of the second derivative to higher dimensional functions, then we can again make a Taylor expansion, which is equation 28. And exactly in the same way as in the one-dimensional case, so we assume that at a certain point of our iteration, we are at that point x tilde, which is now a vector, and then we want to determine a point x, which we call again xm, where the function takes on a minimum, that means the gradient is zero, and therefore if I solve equation 29 for the case where g of x is zero, then I arrive now at equation 31, which is just now this Newton iteration in the high dimensional case. So we see now here we have this inverse a to the minus 1 of the Hessian matrix. So of course in principle you could calculate it in that way. I mean if you could first calculate the Hessian matrix, then invert it, then apply it on the gradient. And actually this quantity, inverse of the Hessian matrix applied on the gradient, that's typically called the preconditioned gradient, and I call it here PL in equation 31. So now instead of first explicitly calculating a to the minus 1 and then applying it on g, actually it's more efficient to solve a linear system of equations, which is given in equation 32. Right, you just say a times p, this preconditioned gradient is equal to the gradient, you solve it, and then you can use this equation 31 to do your Newton iterations. So the Newton iteration has actually a fairly rapid convergence rate, but it has several problems. I mean, first of all, as we have already seen in the one-dimensional case, it's not quite clear where you should evaluate the second derivative, so that means here's a Hessian matrix. And actually also that's related to the fact that of course realistic functions are not quadratic functions, and so the theory that we have derived, I mean this equation 31, which was derived for a quadratic function anyway, is only approximate and not exact. So, of course, it's clear that also in most cases the calculation of the Hessian matrix just by itself will already be expensive. And then also we still have, of course, in addition to solve this linear system of equations, and that also can be expensive. I mean, especially if you have a very high dimensional function, then this, right, if you have a, let's say, a function that depends on 100 variables, then this Hessian matrix is a 100 by 100 matrix. And probably you know that solving a linear system of equation has a cubic scaling. So like if you would go from a 100 by 100 matrix to a 1000 by 1000 matrix, right, then solving this linear system of equations would be 1000 times slower, more expensive, and therefore that can be a real bottleneck in practice. So for that reason, actually, this exact Newton iteration is rarely used, and what is frequently a good compromise is the so-called precondition steepest descent iteration, which is now this equation 33. And there you have now this so-called preconditioning matrix, which is still unspecified. We will discuss later on how to choose it. I mean, there are now real recipes how to choose it. It's very frequently motivated by a kind of physical insight in your system. And you see now, of course, if you choose as a preconditioning matrix the identity matrix times alpha, then we are back to the steepest descent iteration. Whereas if you choose for this preconditioning matrix P, the inverse of the Hessian, so A to the minus 1, then we are back on the to the Newton iteration. Okay, let's now look at the convergence of the steepest descent iteration. So to do this convergence analysis, we have to do a few simplifications to get kind of more or less the same function, but with simpler dependencies. So the first thing what we are doing is we are kind of shifting the function in such a way that it takes on its minimum at the origin, so when this vector x is equal to 0, and then also we shift it up and down in such a way that the minimum value actually is exactly 0. So that's this equation 34. Okay, then that means without any restriction, we can say that our function f of x now is 1/2 times x transposed a times x. Yeah, we can make this function actually still considerably simpler now by applying next a rotation, which is mathematically speaking a unitary transformation. And you know, this matrix A is a positive definite symmetric matrix, so you can find a unitary matrix that will bring it on diagonal form. So that means essentially you have now a new coordinate system, which is now called Y, right? Y, of course, is also a vector. It has components 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. And then in this new rotated coordinate system, then your function takes on an extremely simple form, right? If now in this coordinate system the matrix A is diagonal, then if you look at equation 36, we see that our function now, as expressed in Y, is just equal to the sum 1/2 times the diagonal elements K. So the D of K is now the K's diagonal element of this transformed matrix A, which means of course also that D of K is just is an eigenvalue of this matrix A. And then of course when we calculate the derivative, if we calculate the gradient, if we do the derivative with respect to Y, we get also this extremely simple formula, namely that as a gradient is nothing but the D of K, the diagonal element, the eigenvalue, times Y of K. So now we have really extremely simple functions, and that's kind of illustrated now here on this figure on page 59. There you see now a quadratic function. So as I said already, we have shifted everything in such a way that the minimum is at the origin, and then you see kind of those equal potential lines where the function takes on larger and larger values, let's say 1, 2, 3. And you see the original coordinate system x, and this new coordinate system y, right? So you see also this new coordinate system, I mean, you have kind of the principle, you have found the principal axis of this ellipsoid. And as we have seen before, right now along this new axis, I mean, you have just a simple quadratic function. So the value just depends on the distance from the origin, like one y1 or y2 times a squared times the eigenvalue. Okay, now let's kind of analyze how a minimization would behave for such a quadratic function. So let's first assume, and of course that's typically we don't know it, so it's unrealistic, but let's assume that we start our iteration from this blue point, which is I call now here along the y1 axis. Okay, so we now along this y1 axis, the function has the functional form, the first eigenvalue, so the diagonal element d of 1 times y1 squared. Okay, you see also that if you calculate the gradient, right, by definition the gradient is perpendicular to the equipotential lines. So that means the gradient from this blue point points exactly in the correct direction. It points towards the origin, which means towards the minimum. And now we know from our discussion of one-dimensional functions right here, now if we move in the direction of the gradient, I mean, we have essentially a one-dimensional minimization problem, and we know that the optimal step size is 1 over the second derivative, right? But the second derivative is just the diagonal element or the eigenvalue, which means that now the optimal step size for a steepest descent iteration starting from this blue point would be 1 over d1, right, which is the first eigenvalue. So alpha should be 1 divided by d of 1. So what happens now if we by chance would start from the green point here? In this case again, the gradient points exactly in the direction of the local minimum, but now we know, of course, here along that y2 axis, the curvature is different. The curvature is now here given by the second eigenvalue, so d2, and so now that means the optimal step size would here be 1 over d2. Okay, now of course in practice we don't know where we start, whether our kind of input guess, our starting point for the iteration, whether that's like here by chance on the y1 axis or y2 axis. I mean, in most cases it will not be, so it will be somewhere in between, like what is shown here as this red point. And so the question is now, what kind of step size should I choose in order to guarantee that also from this red point I will converge towards the minimum? So we see that actually, right, when we are on here on the green point, right, then we have a low curvature, which means that we need a large step size, right? We have 1 over the curvature. The curvature is small, so the step size should be large. Whereas if we start from the blue point, the step size should be smaller. Well, now if we have a large step size and we start from the blue point, then as you have seen before, of course, we will kind of overshoot the minimum and actually the whole iteration will diverge. So that means that's the most important thing to guarantee convergence. So we have to be careful. We should choose kind of a step size which guarantees that for any point, starting point, we will converge. And of course that means we have to have a step size 1 divided by the largest eigenvalue, so as a small step size. Okay, what happens then? Again, of course, if we start from the blue point, we know anyway that's an optimal step size. If we start now from the green point, then actually this step size is too small and we have to do a few iterations to arrive at the minimum. If we start now from the red point, then of course you also see that you should kind of do small step sizes. I mean, if you follow the gradient, right, the gradient now, if you start from the red point, does not point exactly in the direction of the local minimum, actually it points in a quite different direction. So we will move along that direction a little bit, but not too much. And then of course we calculate again the gradient. We choose our step sizes, and then you see that we do some kind of zigzag movement, and then finally we will also arrive here at the local minimum. And also in this case, of course, I mean, if with this kind of conservative choice, if you take as your step size the inverse of the largest eigenvalue, then it will be guaranteed that you converge to the minimum. Okay, so let's now do the mathematical analysis. For this now, in this coordinate system Y, the steepest descent iteration becomes equation 37. So this YL plus 1 equals YL minus, right, I have alpha times the gradient, but we have seen before the gradient is just the product of D of K times YL of K. Okay, so that equation now relates L plus 1 with L, but of course then I can relate L to L and L minus 1 and so on recursively until I arrive at Y1. And in every step, right, I get an additional factor of 1 minus alpha D of K. So that's equation 33. So that means if I compare YL plus 1 with YL, then I get this factor of 1 minus alpha D of K to the power L. So you remember we have chosen this coordinate system Y such that the minimum is exactly reached if the vector Y is identically zero. So that means this iteration 38 should converge to zero. And of course that's the case if the absolute value of this factor 1 minus alpha D of K, if that's less than 1. Okay, so that means then alpha, right, should be again should be proportional to 1 over d. And actually, okay, in most cases probably would put it just 1 over d, but we can still introduce a factor t which can vary between 1 and 2, and then in this kind of interval we will get convergence. Yeah, so the component that will converge most slowly, of course, is the one that is associated to the largest eigenvalue. So now requiring this component to be equal to a certain precision, so that's a very small number, right, that kind of measures how close we are to the solution, we then get that, I mean, just this from equation 38, right, together with equation 39, we get that 1 minus t times this ratio d min over d max to the power l has to be equal to this precision. Okay, now we can solve this equation 40 for the number of iterations l to obtain equation number 41. And so we see that the number of iterations l that we need to reach a certain precision p is given by the logarithm of p. So you see it kind of depends actually only weakly on the precision. And then we have a second logarithm. And now it turns out that this ratio d min over d max is typically a very small number. I mean, that's true more or less for any physical application. And if that's the case, then actually I can do a Taylor development of this logarithm, and then I'd arrive at this equation 42, which tells me that the number of iterations, right, as we know already, it's given by the logarithm. And then we have this ratio between d max and d min. So that's an important quantity. So this ratio between the largest and the smallest eigenvalue of the Hessian matrix, that's called the condition number. And so we see that the number of iterations actually is proportional to this kappa, to this condition number. Yeah, as I said, this condition number, I mean, this ratio of the eigenvalues, so this condition number is typically a very large number. I mean, something like perhaps 1,000 is not so unusual, which means that the steepest descent iteration will need of the order of a few thousand iterations to converge to the minimum. That's a fairly big number, and we will see in a moment actually that there are other methods that will allow for a faster convergence to the minimum. Okay, let's now still do a similar convergence analysis now for this steepest descent iteration. I will not now derive you again all the equations, actually I will just show you the result. And the result is this equation 43, which kind of formally looks identical to what we have seen in the steepest descent iteration. The difference now is just that this ratio d max over d min is not the ratio of the eigenvalues of A, but instead of the eigenvalues of this matrix, which is a product of the preconditioning matrix and A. Now, of course, you see that, if the preconditioning matrix is the inverse of the Hessian, then of course this product of P of A is the identity matrix, and then all eigenvalues are 1, so that means this condition number is 1, and then we will have a very rapid convergence. Yeah, so that's indeed what is exploited in this preconditioned steepest descent iteration. Of course, we already also know that this choice P equals the inverse of A is not a choice that is very useful in practice, because it's too expensive to calculate P to the minus 1. So typically, a preconditioning matrix has to satisfy two requirements. First of all, of course, the preconditioning matrix should be a reasonable approximation to A to the minus 1, but it doesn't have to be exactly equal to A to the minus 1. Then on the other hand, of course, it should be a matrix that's easy to evaluate, and also easy to apply on to a vector, right? Because if we have the steepest descent iteration, we have to apply this preconditioning matrix on our gradient to get this preconditioned gradient along which we will move in our minimization scheme. So so you see that this preconditioning can make a big difference in the condition number, and therefore it can make a big difference in the number of iterations that's needed to find the minimum. And so a good preconditioning matrix can very significantly speed up finding the global minimum. And if it's chosen in a clever way, then handling this preconditioning matrix and applying it onto a vector is numerically not too expensive.